In this next session, we have two speakers who will talk to us about living and leading mission in the spirit of Mary MacKillop. Our first speaker will be Mrs. Kath Evans, who's become well known as the person whose cure from cancer in 1996 was accepted as the second miracle in the cause for the canonisation of Mary MacKillop. So Kath and her husband Barry went to Rome and took part in the canonisation ceremonies, and hearing Kath speak in workshops and just in the casual times, it sounds to me like maybe that was the beginning of a quite new call to mission for Kath. So she'll speak to us about her experience. And we'll also be joined by Sister Mary Ellen O'Donoghue, who is a sister of St. Joseph, who has a background in education. She's the CEO of Good Grief Limited. And Good Grief is probably best known for its flagship program, Seasons for Growth. I'll give you Kath Evans.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Leading and living the mission in the spirit of our Saint Mary MacKillop. How can I be so bold to stand up here and say that I walk in the spirit of Mary MacKillop? It's far beyond anything I've ever dreamed of, that one day I'd be doing that. But here I am, doing just that. Now, I'm not a professional speaker, but I've had to learn to be a public speaker. And I don't usually talk at conferences like this. So I'm just warning you, okay? might not be what you expect. Firstly, I have to tell you a little bit about myself, about my sickness and the connection with Mary MacKillop. To start with, we're not only speaking about me, we're speaking about my husband, Barry, who's my partner and he does everything with me. He's not here today. He was hoping to get to the talk, but I think parking will be his problem. I come from the Diocese of Maitland, Newcastle, in New South Wales. It's about 2.5 hours from here, Sydney. I lived at Raymond Terrace when I was first married, and my first two daughters went to Raymond Terrace school, and they were taught by the Sisters of Mercy. And when they were in year three, third year and third class and second class, we shifted to a small town in Lake Macquarie called Windale. Now, Windale over the years has always been a government housing school, and it's about 97% government housing. So we've always carried the stigma of being a very poor town, and with that, of course, comes the highest crime rate and everything like that. But I stand here and I'm very proud to have been a resident of Windale and to call myself a Windalian. It was a great place to be. And my sickness was 20 years ago this year. And I don't think that I could have been in any better town than that little town of Windale in Lake Macquarie. By the time we got to Windale, I had a couple of extra children. And the Federation Josephites from Lochinvar had the school at Windale. So my first four children were educated by those wonderful sisters from Lochinvar. Unfortunately, when I was there in Windale, my marriage broke down, and I found it much too hard. I was brought up in a very strict Catholic household. The family that prayed together stayed together. That was our family motto. I had a special blessing from the Pope sent out from Rome for my wedding. In those days, It was in the 60s. If you wanted to have a full nuptial mass, you had to be married before noon. And so I was married at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I was married at the Parochial Cathedral Church at Maitland. The children went to a Catholic school. We always thanked God for our food before we ate it. We never went to bed without praying. And where was my God in all this? Here I was, left with four children. It was much easier for me to actually walk away from my church. And I did. And I stayed away for 10 years. And there's an old saying, you don't know what you've got until you haven't got it anymore. And that was very true with me. I was born into the Catholic faith. And when I threw it away, I realised what I had missed and what I had actually got rid of. And I didn't know how to get back. The best thing that happened in that 10 years is I married Barry and we had another son called Luke. And it was through Luke, when he was making his first Holy Communion, and the help of Barry, that I actually came back into our church. Things really started to look up then. I no longer had my parents' faith. I was brought up with the fire and the brimstone. If you didn't go to Mass on Sunday, it was a mortal sin. And if you ate meat on Friday, you're out the door. But when I came back, I found this loving Jesus. I found a Jesus that would forgive me anything that I had ever done, as long as I was sorry. Jesus and I became like two peas in a pod. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, was that conversion, being away and then coming back. And Jesus is my mate. He started to be my mate then, and he's still my mate now. The only thing was that he asked me to give my life to him, and it took me a long time to say yes. But when I did, it was only about 18 months, and then we had another blow, which I couldn't understand. You ask me to give your life to you, and I do, and then all of a sudden you're killing me off. What's all this about? Because in 1993, I was diagnosed with a non-small carcinoma cell in my right lung. And after many, many tests, I was sent by my doctor to a heart and lung surgeon. And what that surgeon was hoping to do was to take out my right lung, because Luke was 13 at the time and he was in year 8 at St Mary's. And by taking out my lung, the doctor was hoping that I could see Luke through his schooling. When he put me into hospital for a biopsy, he found that the cancer had come out of the lung and it had gone into all the glands. And the gland he was most worried about was the one that was close to the heart. And that gland was full of cancer and it had to be removed. The specialist was sending me home for the weekend to have another look at the tests that he had taken from my lung. And before I left, he asked for an X-ray on my head, and he rang Barry on Monday and said, I'm sorry, I can't touch your wife. We've found a spot on her brain, at the bottom of her brain. And he said, I wouldn't do the operation and risk losing her on the table. From there, I was sent to the Mater Hospital, where I was told chemotherapy was just simply not on because my cancer was too aggressive. I could have ray treatment, but the ray would only take or ease my side effects down and may give me 2 weeks on the other end of my life. Now, by this time, I was given 2 months to live. And 2 weeks of going into the martyr every day for a little of ray treatment for 5 or 6 minutes just wasn't on. I was too sick. And so that's when I decided that I'd have no more treatment. I always have trouble with this. Now, I thought I had it all worked out before I left. What's wrong with it? Oh, there it is. Okay. So I went back to my doctor and I asked him if he would see me through till the end, and he said he would. Now, that was when that first photo was taken of me in a lounge chair. And after that, for the next couple of weeks, I went downhill very, very quickly. I got to the point where I couldn't even get out of bed, and Barry had to do everything for me. If he was here, he'd say, I'm still doing it too, but that's not true. This is when Mary MacKillop came into my life. Mary MacKillop wasn't even a blessed Mary MacKillop then. My daughter Julie's mum-in-law gave her a relic of Mary to give to me and a novena prayer. And her name was Anne. Anne had a very good friend in North Sydney, a sister of St. Joseph, and her name was Sister Inez. And Sister Inez was going to do an official novena through the sisters in North Sydney. And she asked Anne that if we could start a novena at the same time and we'd all pray together. We had our parish and our friends. We had our youth group. Barry and I at the time were parent couple to our youth group in our diocese called Antioch. And we also had our Anglican friends had taken a novena too. And that was really beautiful, because it's not something that they do in their church, novenas. But they were very good friends of ours and they were already praying for us. So they took the novena too. Within three days of the novena starting, I was actually able to go back out in that lounge room and sit in that lounge chair. Now, I couldn't stay there all day, but it was a start. I hadn't been able to do it for weeks. And by the time the novena was finished, and within about 3 or 4 days, that's me actually out in the lollabout in the backyard. Now, those two photos give me goosebumps every time I talk about them and every time I look at them. Because that little fella on my knee is James, and he's one of my grandchildren. He's now 20. And as you can see by that first photo, you can see his size, he was about 5 months old. And the second photo, it was just when over 6 months old. And that's me in that chair. And we had prayer right from the very start of my sickness. We had special masses. And it wasn't until that novena was said that I started to improve. Oh, I'm going to give this up. I've only got one more photo. Come on, help me. There it is. In early September, I went with 24 other women to Lochinvar convent on a retreat. Now, they made me up a bed up there so that I could lay on the floor, just in case I got too weak. I never laid on that bed once. I never missed a session. And this was at the end of September. Our daughter Lisa was getting married at the end of October. And not only did I go to her wedding, that's us there, and it really is us. I've got a different figure. And if you knew Barry, if he was here today, he's got hair. But it is us. And not only did I go and I had a couple of dances at her wedding, but I went with her at the beginning of October to help her pick out that wedding dress. Now, that's something a mother longs to do, but I was supposed to be dead. And that's within 3 months of me being told I had cancer. November brought my 50th birthday, and the parish gave me a big surprise party. The thing was, I was back at church doing, well, they didn't let me do much, but I could do a little thing, a few things. And every meeting or something I went to, as I opened the door, it was surprise, surprise. I had so many surprise birthday parties for my 50th that I've never had one since. Party, that is, not even surprise. Ah, dear. My doctor wanted me to go back to have some more tests done by Christmas time, but I was feeling that I was up and about. I wasn't completely better. I still thought I was dying. I still carried the pains in my chest, and I still, couldn't walk very far. I found out I couldn't walk very far being down here this week either. And he said to me, he knew that we'd turned to prayer. He knew about Mary MacKillop. And he said, you know, it may be just laying dormant and you're having special time with your family. And that's what we really thought we were having. He said it could have gone to another part of your body too. And when it comes back out, it'll come out worse than before. Or he said it could have shrunk. And he said, I'd love to know what's happening in your body. Well, I didn't want to know. I was quite happy where I was, and I said, no, I'm not ready to do that. And it wasn't until April the following year in 94 that I actually went to him and said, well, I'm ready now. I'll go and have those tests done. That was 10 months after I was told that I had cancer. I went and had an X-ray. And to everyone's amazement, the cancer had completely gone. And the only thing that was there in my lungs was the scar. It was scar tissue where the cancer had been, and a collapsed bronchial tube. And within a couple of months, when I had the second lot of X-rays on my lungs, the scar tissue had gone, and the bronchial tube had righted itself. In that time, between that first X-ray and that X-ray, I had all tests done, and the cancer had gone completely out of my head and everything. After this great news, I wanted to give something back. This started my mission. I found an organisation called Make Today Count, and their purpose was to journey with people with life-threatening illnesses. I worked there for close on 11 years, and I can honestly say that I received much more than I gave. It's really a great honour to sit with somebody who's dying. And they were the cases I was given because of my situation, someone who was told they didn't have long to live. I even learnt to do funerals for people who didn't want church funerals. It was to me a great ministry. I followed up that with working with children who had lost their one or two of their parents in some way, mostly cancer. I was told in prayer at the beginning of this ministry that I wouldn't be left in that ministry forever. But little did I know what was to follow. After the Pope declared my case a miracle, I wanted to go back and this was before the canonisation, I wanted to go back to Windale to thank those people for keeping my story quiet. Because the one stipulation that came out of Rome was that my story wasn't to go to media. Because if my story went to media and got big before the Pope said, yes, this is a miracle, they would have squashed Mary MacKillop's cause in Rome. And so that was a pretty big burden for us. And it was a pretty big burden for a little town like Windale to keep that quiet too. Because, you know, they were often criticised for things that happened in Windale. And this was something good and they had to keep it quiet. So the parish priest there reckoned that that was the third miracle. Little did we know when I went back and did that talk that there was something that was going to be the turning point that changed our lives completely. I then really thought about when God asked me to do his work many years before that. I really knew what he meant then. Because that one talk has turned into over 190 talks right through Australia. We have talked in every state, sharing our life with people who are broken and sick and ostracised from our church. And there's a lot of people out there who are really broken. There's so many people who are searching for something to cling on to, something that they really believe in. And I suppose my ministry is helping them to have something there to cling on to. It hasn't been real easy for Barry and I to step out of our comfort zone in faith and go around and share our story, not only our story, but also the story of our wonderful saint, Mary MacKillop. One of Mary's sayings is, with God on your side, you need never fear. And you know what? It's so true for me today. I have no fear when I do these talks because I know God is with me and I'm doing his work. I have this inner peace that settles over me. I get a great excitement that comes from the heart, and I can talk for hours if you let me. I never write my talks, not like this today. This is hard for me. It just flows out of me. And I even have question time halfway through the talks. And, you know, there never has been one time when I haven't been able to answer a question. Now, that's not me. And anyone who knows me can vouch for that. I'm not a person that can answer questions at the drop of a hat. So I know it is God's work. Barry and I, we still get this amazing feeling when people come up to us and say, gee, that was great, and I got so much out of that talk. It's awesome how God will work through us if we only let him. Psalm 46, which I do love, says, Be still and know I am God. That's really all we have to do, is to be still and listen to him, and he'll lead us on. We have just come back from Perth, where I did some talks. And after one of these, a man came up to me who had just been diagnosed with the same kind of cancer as me in his lungs, and it also has gone to his brain. He was about the same age as I was when I was first diagnosed. And I spoke at 7 o'clock this night, and he said just by chance, around about five-ish, he heard I was talking. And he said to his wife, "I've got to go. I've got to go to that talk." He said, "I didn't know why, but I knew I had to go." The wonderful thing about it was, he said, as I was talking, he felt this peace flow through him. And he actually felt, it's very emotional when you get these stories, he actually felt that the talk was just for him. And he'd come and he'd ask me if I'd pray for him. And we're going to keep in touch with one another. And we do keep in touch with quite a few people who are really sick that come to these talks. I did a talk in Newcastle when we came back from Perth, and it was for the VIEW Club. And the VIEW Club stands for Voice, Interest and Education for Women. And when I spoke about Mary McKillop's work with the poor children, of what she did and how she did it, through the audience I heard all these noises like, and when I sat down, the chairperson said to me, "You know, when you were talking about what Mary McKillop did, that's what we do. Our fundraising goes into helping poor kids' education." And it gives you goosebumps, doesn't it? And I thought, gee whiz, and I said to her, "You're doing Mary's work too." And she said, "You know what? That's what I felt like." Now that is amazing, because Mary McKillop is not just our church's saint. She's a saint for all Australia. And hearing things like that, you realise that she is not just ours. She's everyone's. Barry and I, we have visited many places that Mary McKillop has taught at and has walked on and has arrived there in horse and sulky and coaches. And we have a comfortable car with an air conditioner in, and we still come home buggered. So how did she do it? I don't know. She was an amazing woman. Mary was an ordinary woman who did extraordinary things in her life. And that has been written so much about. But to me, she's more than an ordinary woman. Now, when I really say an ordinary woman, I mean that she was an ordinary woman in the way that she could relate to people. She could relate to young and old and rich and poor on their level. So that was the ordinariness of her. But she was no ordinary woman. She was an amazing woman. One of Mary's sayings is, "My good God." And that was taught to her by her mum when she was young. I try so hard to walk in Mary's spirit. And, you know, it's not easy. Last month we did an extensive tour of Rockhampton Diocese, and I started at Bundaberg. Barry couldn't come with me. He met me at Rockhampton. And it was just after the flood. It was just a couple of weeks after the flood up in Bundaberg, and a tornado went through with it. And the man I was staying with was on the council, the head of the council, and he took me around to the places that were affected by this tornado. And, you know, you see it on TV, but it's nothing like what it is in person. And the army had been in to clear some of it up. So one house, there was a little cement, just a little cement block with a toilet on it, nothing else on the land at all. The next house looked as though nothing had happened. But the things that really brought tears to my eyes was that big holes in the ground and houses were just swallowed up into them. The houses were still there. The curtains were still on the window. You know, it was devastating. The man told me that it was the third flood they've had in just a little over a year. And a lot of the insurance companies had put the insurance so far up they weren't insured anymore. It was really devastating. And it was a time when I wonder where our good God was. Why has this happened? Where are you, good God? We don't always have sad cases, you know. I was asked to do a talk in Darwin in 2011. I was up in Darwin and they asked me if I'd come to the orientation day of the Mary MacKillop College up there. And I said, yes, I'd love to. And I went there and all that was there was the foundations of the new school. It hadn't even been built. And we were having orientation day. A busload of children come that was going to school the following year there. The bishop was there and, you know, we had the ceremony out on the street because we couldn't get on the site. It was too dangerous. They asked me up the next year for the opening of this school and I went and we had it at the school in the weather shed or the weather cover, but the school hadn't started because the school was still at the university. But they were to go into the school in a couple of weeks' time. You know, Darwin do things in their own way and they're entirely different to anyone else. I'd never been to an opening of a school when the kids didn't go to school there. But I had an email from one of the sisters that worked there only before I'd just come down here, and she said that the enrolment for that school has doubled this year. So it's doing very well, our Mary MacKillop College up in Darwin. I talk about my good God, so I just like to say that in 1981, Mary said, "Look back a little and see what our good God has done for us." And so that's what I did when I was writing this story. I looked back and to see what my good God had done for me. And, you know, he has done many, many more things good for me than not good. I have 5 children. And when I was sick, I had 6 grandchildren. Now I have 21. That's 15 children into our family that I should never have seen. Wonderful. I have a great husband, which I'm sure God picked for me the second time around because I botched up the first one. I'm an ordinary woman that's had this extraordinary favour bestowed on her. Where do I live? I live on the property of St. Joseph's at Kingcumber. And that's a place that Mary MacKillop started her boys' home in 1887. And it doesn't matter where I walk on that property, I feel Mary. So what do you think of my good God's done for me? He's done many, many things. At the moment, my mission is talking in schools and parishes and senior groups and other churches, not Catholic churches, and non-church groups. I don't know how long this will last, but I'm sure that when it is finished, my good God will have something else for me to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kath. You've been on an amazing journey. I'm sure there's a great deal more to say as well. Sister Mary Ellen is going to... Mary Ellen is going to follow on quite briefly, and I'll just invite you to come directly to the microphone.
I'm just conscious of the time frame, so we'll just see what we can do. I'm the CEO of Good Grief, and my PowerPoint isn't going to match what I'm going to say, so we'll just see how we go, all right? In 2008, I was working, I'd only just begun the ministry at Good Grief, and I received a letter from one of our sisters asking me what I could do for an Aboriginal community in the APY lands in South Australia. A 9-year-old child there had actually committed suicide. I felt really overwhelmed at the time and didn't really know how you actually could respond to that kind of a situation. And I put it on back burner because I knew that it would require cash, and we didn't have any cash. Like most ministries, we all struggle with money most of the time, I think. In more recent years, we received some money through the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Foundation. And working in the most extraordinary collaborative partnership over the last 18 months, we've been able to develop a program that is designed to enable people to come to a place of wholeness in terms of their own grief and loss. So I'm going to skip to that part of the process here, if I can. I'll just whack through these. If we go to this particular Aboriginal community, we can be quite confronted by the sense of disconnection and fragmentation and what have you in that community. And as a minister, as the leader of this ministry group, we were quite overwhelmed by that experience, and we found ourselves kind of entering into transgenerational grief, complex grief, and all the layers of grief that happen within that kind of a context. And I found myself as the leader of that ministry asking the question, what does the reign of God mean or demand in that kind of a situation? And how can I help the people that I'm working with and that I'm collaborating with to really understand what the fullness of life really means? This quotation, I think, from Sandra Snyder's in many ways sums up some of that experience for us. She says in that fantastic article on ministerial religious life, she says, "This good news is not pie in the sky bye-bye, consolation after death, for those who patiently bear irremediable misery in this life. It is release to captives, freedom to the oppressed, a new state of state of affairs here and now in which domination, exclusion, stigma, discrimination and oppression of all kinds by state and church is overcome." And that's really what we in our small way were hoping to begin the struggle with. I think this picture for me sums up what the experience of the last particularly 6 months has been, that sense of people coming back to life. The program we've developed is called Seasons for Healing, and we've borrowed from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Foundation in using their logo, motto thing, you know that thing? Strong spirit, strong culture, strong people, because that's really what we want for all people. That's what the reign of God really is all about. Thomas Merton says it so beautifully. He says, "We all exist solely for this, to be the human place God has chosen for his presence, his manifestation, his epiphany." And our good friend Mary McKillop that is such a good friend of Kath's, and who Kath makes Mary come alive, I think. And she says, do what you can with the means at your disposal and leave the rest calmly to God. And so for me, as the leader of this ministry, while I would look at things like active engagement and, you know, being convinced about the mission and so on, the thing that probably keeps me going most days and gets me up in the morning is that very simple thing that Mary says about leaving the rest for God. And I will leave the rest for God.
Thank you, Sister Mary Ellen. We have a little gift for each of you to thank you for your presentations today and for your sharing with us. Thank you both for your contributions.